Daily Radio Room at Bristol's Empire and Commonwealth Museum by Temple Meads Station. In a week that's seen the Empire and Commonwealth Museum itself in the news, we're off to Stoke Gifford, where a retired merchant banker tells us all about the Northern Rock crisis and the implications for our savings. We pay a visit to Bristol's beleaguered old Vic Theatre and hear allegations that the theatre's director is ducking responsibility for the crisis by gagging employees. And in the Empire and Commonwealth Museum archive, we hear from an ex-military governor in Palestine about the plight of ordinary villagers after the Second World War, in the run-up to the creation of the State of Israel in 1947. We have a few surprises as ever, plus our main man, Jeff Sparks, is here with his weekly What's On guide. That's all after the news with John Peters Coleman.
The British Empire and Commonwealth Museum is to move from Bristol to London and could shut by autumn 2008. The trustees say they want to move the award-winning museum from its home here in Isambard Kingdom Brunel's original Temple Meads Station to reach a larger international audience. The museum, the only one in the world dedicated to the history of the British Empire, was opened by Princess Anne in 2002. In a statement released yesterday, Museum Director Dr. Gareth Griffiths said, "Relocation to London presents a major opportunity for the museum to widen its reach and engage new audiences. We have enjoyed great success over the last 5 years of operation and are extremely grateful to the people of Bristol and all who have supported us." The 1840 Grade 1 listed building, which is the world's first railway terminus, has enjoyed a £7 million restoration since the museum moved in, earning it a nomination as a World Heritage Site. Artist and poet Belginda Bopal, 46 from Easton, has recently had her work on display at the museum. She said, "It was a shame for the people of Bristol that the move was happening, but that the size of the 75,000 artefact archive meant the premises could not do justice to the collection." Miss Bopal said, "It's a blow for Bristol, but it's probably a good thing for the museum itself. I always felt that Bristol didn't support it enough, which was a pity. Bristol just doesn't make enough of its cultural resources." The news comes less than a year after the closure of the city's Wild Walk nature attraction and IMAX cinema. Journalists must learn from the mistakes made in the build-up to the current war in Iraq as they cover the present situation with Iran. This was the message to come out of the Media Workers Against the War conference at the London School of Economics last week. Those voicing the warning for journalists included Tony Benn, former New Statesman editor, now Guardian columnist Peter Wilby, The Guardian's Nick Davies, veteran investigative journalist Philip Knightley and the Evening Standard's Andrew Gilligan. Speaking of the run-up to the current conflict in Iraq, Ben said, "We were lied to over the case for the war, and the only people who were punished and lost their jobs were Piers Morgan, Andrew Gilligan, Greg Dyke and David Kelly, who died." According to Wilby, the systematic failures of journalism that have led to problems in the coverage of the Iraq war will, in my view, lead to similar problems in the coverage of the Iran war, which I'm sure is going to come sooner or later. Several speakers pointed out that while the New York Times and Washington Post have published fulsome apologies for the uncritical coverage they gave to the case for the war against Iraq 5 years ago, the British press has made no such mea culpa. Wilby pointed out that in his own paper, The Guardian, recently ran a front-page story based on unnamed US sources warning of Iran's military threat, without a word from any other sources. Nick Davies said he believes the Observer's coverage in the run-up to the war with Iraq was deliberately and successfully manipulated by security sources, and that this was vital because this is the paper read by backbench Labour MPs. According to Gilligan, the government manipulated press coverage in the run-up to the current war in Iraq by a systematic use of Chinese whispers, leaking untrue stories to favoured journalists, which were then confirmed to other journalists writing follow-ups, thus satisfying their news editors. He said that stories which journalists found through their own investigations were successfully stifled by official sources through denials. He urged journalists to put in the work to check stories, even if this was at the expense of easy headlines, saying, "We've got to learn the lessons, we've got to do the work and make sure nothing like that happens with Iran." Bristol has recorded the biggest drop in the amount of rubbish being sent to landfill in the country after a number of bin bags thrown out by local families was cut by almost a quarter. Government figures revealed 21% less waste was disposed of by the City Council over the last year, putting it at the top of the league table for the most improved unitary authorities. It also cut the amount of municipal waste from parks and gardens and commercial properties. It buries in the ground by 12%, the 8th most improved rate nationally. It follows a major overhaul of waste disposal in the city last year. Overall, the Bristol region matched the national average, 31%, for the amount of waste being recycled per household.
Thank you very much, John Peters Coleman. The queues outside Northern Rock are worrying, particularly since the problems with the US economy which gave rise to them have not gone away. Could more banks be in for a rough ride? This crisis throws up so many questions. Could Britain ever be hit by a banking panic similar to that which hit Argentina back in 2001, when millions of people lost all their savings? Could the so-called IMF riots ever happen here? Stoke Gifford is home to Chris Hawkins, retired merchant banker. Dialect's Tony Gosling asked him about the roots of the crisis and for his all-important independent expert advice. Have we seen the last of the queues?
My name's Chris Hawkins. For a number of years I worked for a firm of merchant bankers, and after that worked in the private sector for broking organisations, handling loans, mortgage and insurance affairs. Looking at the Northern Rock policy over the last few years. When I first went into merchant banking, I was told the recipe for disaster was to borrow short and to lend long. And that means you go on to the banking money markets, and you can borrow money for as little as 1 day, a week, or a month. And what Northern Rock did is that they entered into fairly tight borrowing arrangements with other, what we call joint stock banks, people like Lloyds, Barclays, some of the huge banking conglomerates in Switzerland, Geneva. And they would borrow money over a period of 2 or maybe 3 years and then use that money to lend it to people who wanted mortgages. And they did fixed rate interest as well, which again is okay when your market is relatively stable. But when the market becomes disturbed, which has happened because of the happenings in America, then of course you start to run into trouble. Now, because of the disturbances in the money markets in America, which arose out of a policy of if you could breathe and your eyes were open, you could have some money for whatever purpose you wanted. So that people with very poor risks, who possibly couldn't even do what we call service their loans, and that is if you were borrowing 200 and having to repay £200 per month, you might in some cases only be earning about £250 or £300 a month, because these were people on welfare benefits in the States. So eventually they run into trouble. Now, what the American banks did is they parcelled up some of their mortgage contracts and then would sell them on to another bank in another part of the world to share the risk out. So when things started to go wrong, the money market then dries up. And what happened with Northern Rock, when they came to renew their 2 and 3 year contracts with the banking organisations throughout the world that they'd borrowed from, they found the money wasn't there. And it was as simple as that. Now, you could say that the Bank of England, which has always been the lender of last resource, and I've never been privy to how often in financial crises in the past that this money has been put on demand with the Bank of England and never disclosed. And the arrangement is that the Bank of England don't lend our money. They guarantee the money which is lent by your joint stock banks again, so that if there is a default in the future, then obviously the other banks will have to cough up. But so really Northern Rock had a liquidity problem. When the news leaked out under the new Bank of England arrangements for openness of both government and banking. Of course, what would you do if you heard that your bank had had to run round to the equivalent of the pawnbroker, put some of their possessions on hock so that they had some cash? You'd think, well, is my money really safe in Northern Rock? So, of course, that's resulted in the queues.
So, isn't this a crisis of regulation, do you think? Maybe in the United States and in Britain, that really the regulators should have made sure that this wasn't possible?
Absolutely. And since 1997 or 98, when the Bank of England was given independence on interest rates, at the same time, the regulation of banking institutions was handed out to three organisations: the bank, who had always done an extremely good job in the past, the financial services organisation, and the government department, the Treasury. Now, the last people in this world I would give any kind of supervision job to are the Treasury. I don't think in the 10 years or so that the Labour Party have been in power, the Treasury have managed to get their forecasting correct. And it doesn't just end with the Labour Party. I think some of the crises that the Conservatives had in the previous 18 years arose from the inability of Treasury mandarins to be able to think straight. Many of these prime mortgages, with poor risks, being given money, no one really knows the extent of the total sums involved. So that unless all the major banks in the world come clean and say, well, how much of the liability do they have, we can't be certain that we're going to have another 1929 situation. I think the worrying thing is one's never quite certain who owns the bank that you're using. I mean, the days of being able to go into the Midland, I think it's HSB, but I'm not certain how much of HSB is controlled by other large financial institutions in the Far East. So I don't think we quite need to start putting our money under the mattress again, but these are worrying days, and we may be lucky and escape, but it could quite conceivably happen during the next 12, 18 months, 2 years, that we have a terrible financial crash. And that not only affects the banking system, it affects industry, commerce, because we all need money to operate.
So is there anything that ordinary people can do to try and make sure that they don't get affected too badly by that?
You could always try moving your money into various different financial institutions. The other thing is, if you've got cash which you don't particularly need, I should imagine the government are going to be paying quite good dividends on what are called gilts, which is government lending. To use a bookmaker's analogy, hedge your bets.
Chris Hawkins there, retired merchant banker who lives in Stoke Gifford, giving us his inside insight into the Northern Rock queues.
Was enough, and it was all in vain. Time starts to pass before you know it, you're frozen. But something happened for the very first time with you. My heart melted to the ground, found something true. And everyone's looking round, thinking I'm going crazy. But I don't care what they say, I'm in love with you. It
Dialect is a community project run by volunteers, and we need you. If you'd like to get involved, check out our website at radiodialect.net.
Just who is to blame for the financial downfall of the Bristol Old Vic? Is it former director David's far poor choice of over-intellectual and experimental plays? Or artistic director Simon Reed's overzealous use of budget? Whoever is to blame, it cannot fail to be noted that the calibre of entertainment at the Bristol Old Vic has seen a sad decline since the likes of George Costigan's one-man show Byron, plays such as 12 Angry Men and the rise and fall of Little Voice. According to a close inside source, Reed has placed a gagging order on anyone officially naming him responsible for the demise of the oldest working theatre in Britain, and has threatened legal repercussions should his name publicly become synonymous with the theatre's nearest potential plunge into extinction. Having just returned from Dublin, where I went to see some exceedingly high-quality theatre productions, it saddens me deeply to think that Bristol, a so-say cultural oasis, has to resort to diminutive dissident venues in order to keep theatre alive in Bristol. I went down to the Old Vic to talk to Scott Rogers, Head of Communications and Development. Afterwards, I went downstairs to a bar to ask current patrons what they believe to be the reason for the Old Vic's closure.
Hi, I'm with Scott Rogers from the Bristol Old Vic.
Hello.
Hello, thank you very much for doing this interview today. Would you like to tell Radio Dialect a bit about what you do and what's going on with the Old Vic at the moment?
My job title is Head of Communications and Development, so basically in charge of press and fundraising. So it's kind of, we're at the stage now where we've launched our public appeal, which is nearly 1 million now. So, and that was since July. So that's a really good response from the Bristol public. And we're now entering into the phase to get the next million. So part of that process is we're launching our seat appeal. So people can buy a seat. And today we have several different types of seat that people can come in and sit in, give us their opinion about whether it's good lumbar support or good armrest, bad armrest, the sort of stuff that they want. They can also sponsor a seat from anything from £225 up to £5,000, have their name on the back of the seat. So that's kind of that's the next phase of the fundraising appeal.
I know you could buy mugs with Bristol Old Vic. Are you still selling mugs?
We don't have as much merchandise as we did while we were open, but there is still a limited amount of merchandise on sale.
I understand that Prunella Scales did a video, didn't she, not long ago, concerning the funding for the Old Vic.
There is a fundraising DVD which will be launched later this month.
Right, would you like to tell us a bit about that?
Not until I've launched it, no.
Okay. Do you know when that will be launched?
November the 21st.
Okay. So at the moment you're mainly concerned with the funding for the Old Vic, and it's going well at the moment?
Yeah, very well. We're really pleased.
Excellent. So is there a date of when the Old Vic might reopen? Or?
Opening late 2008, early 2009, with a refurbishment of this nature, it's very difficult to have an exact date.
Right, so I thought the old chair's gone from downstairs then now?
No.
They haven't?
No.
I think that was, for me, is one of the most uncomfortable things, especially like myself, I have arthritis, and if your mobility is restricted, it was just hell seeing a play.
Yeah, and so basically one of the reasons for the refurbishment is to completely reseat the auditorium, air conditioning into the auditorium, and to realign some of the seats so that we have better sight lines. So as an audience member, after the refurbishment, the auditorium will be a much nicer environment to watch a play in.
Are you losing any space by getting new chairs?
We will lose a limited amount of space, but then that's to give us the facility for better legroom.
Right, and so when it does reopen, I understand there isn't going to be a box office anymore, is that right?
No.
No?
No box office. How would we sell tickets?
Well, I understand it was going to be done by like an 0845 number.
No.
No? So what, you'll be recruiting staff once you reopen?
There will be a fully operational box office.
Right, okay. It's just that I was told that by someone that used to work here on the box office. So. Right, okay.
Not quite sure how you can function as a theatre without a box office.
Well, no, I agree with you there, but that's just what I was told. I just wanted to question.
There are an awful lot of untruths out there as far as this building is concerned. We will reopen. We will reopen as a theatre. We will have a box office.
Why do you think there's so many untruths at the moment?
It's a very difficult question to answer. There are an awful lot of people who, for example, your contact, saying that there will be no box office. Ill-informed, making up their own mind, not necessarily quoting the fact that has come from this building. So it's way beyond our control to limit, for example, what you've heard. Quite incredible that they think there will not be a box office in this building. You cannot sell tickets without having a box office. Or if you can, I don't know of a way to do it.
Well, I know some places you just phone a number. You know, like, say, if you're going for a show in London, you can just ring a ticket line, can't you?
I don't know a theatre in London that doesn't have a box office. Okay. And I've worked in a lot of theatres in the country, and they have to have a box office. It's kind of... That's...
So when it reopens, it could be a whole new, like, director and a whole new team of staff?
Yeah, of course.
And so how do you feel about... How long have you been here? I don't know how long you've been here, sorry.
I've been here since February.
Since February. So you haven't seen any... Have you seen any of the productions at Bristol or Vicar Pot in the past, or not really?
Yes.
You have?
I've lived in the area for 17 years.
Oh, same as me. I've been in Bristol 17 years.
I haven't been in Bristol, I lived in the area.
Oh, right, okay. Right, because some of the productions weren't... I think they were ill-chosen. I don't think that helped the old Vic, really. And there's been quite a few changes in people dealing with the choice of plays, haven't there?
Well, you will expect a change in artistic policy driven by the current artistic director. So, yes, there have been good choices, bad choices... I've only been here since February, so I can only say that from an outsider. Yes, there are things I've been wanted to come and see, and the things that I haven't wanted to come and see. But that's me personally.
So, what's the best thing you've ever seen here, off the top of your head?
Rise and Fall of Little Mice.
Oh, that was amazing! Absolutely superb. Good choice.
Yeah.
So, what about the new Vic? What's happening with that?
The studio.
Yeah.
The studio, again, will have some refurbishment work done to it. At the moment, we will shortly be housing the Bristol Vic Theatre School. And that's simply because the contractors haven't got anywhere near the studio. The electrics are still in a working order, so we're able to house them. The reason we're able to house them is because they come with their own infrastructure.
Right.
They have all of their own front of house staff, they have their own box office, they have the insurance, they have the technical know-how, so they are kind of self-contained. Really all we're doing is renting them the space.
Well, so they'll be performing here?
So that's
an opportunity for people to come and see some theatre at the Old Vic?
Yes, in the studio.
And when will that be, do you know?
That's from the 8th of November.
Oh, excellent. That's really good news. So that the building will be used for some sort of theatrical entertainment.
Yeah.
Brilliant. Well, thank you very much for your time today.
It's all right.
Thank you very much, Scott Rogers.
Thank you.
I'm here down at the Bristol Old Vic Bar at the moment, actually trying out some new seats when and if they do eventually reopen. I have with me here a patron who wishes to remain nameless. Could you give me your view on what's happening with the Old Vic?
Well, I just think it's gone a bit to pot over the last few years, which I've got to say is partly down to artistic direction, or the direction they've chosen to go in.
Right.
It obviously hasn't put the funds on seats, as it should have done, otherwise it wouldn't be quite the trouble they're in at the moment.
So you would agree that this is a major contributory factor to the reason why it's closed right now?
I also think it obviously needed a huge input of finance. I mean, it hasn't been touched for a very, very long time. I mean, the last major overhaul was when Chris Hall came in and all the backstage was ripped out and upgraded, except front of house wasn't touched at that point, as far as I can recall.
Yeah, I mean, don't you think that this whole idea of buy a mug, sponsor a seat, it's a bit like the old Vic's prostituting itself?
I think is very sad that a theatre of this age and this
calibre,
and looking around the display here, looking at the actors and actresses who have been here, who are international renown.
Absolutely. Who cut their teeth here.
Yeah, absolutely. Wouldn't be here without it. I mean, that linked through with the Bristol Old Vic.
I know.
Theatre school.
I know.
It's provided a bedrock for British theatre, you know, Bristol theatre. And
yeah.
I think it's a tragedy that the Old Vic is at this stage in its history. Very shame. But it will pull through.
I certainly hope so. Thanks very much for your time.
Thank you.
Scott Rogers there, and a patron of the Old Vic who wishes to remain nameless. I'd just like to explain that the noise in the background there was an alarm, just to prove that it was actually live.
Radio Dialect is your local internet radio station. Check out our website on radiodialect.net.
This city has quite an active anti-war movement, and Bristol Stop the War Coalition includes members of most of the political parties, as well as trades unionists and people from faith groups, as well as many of Bristol's ordinary citizens with no particular affiliation other than for peace and against war. Anyway, the coalition are having a march and rally today in the city centre under the dual banner of troops being pulled out of Iraq and Afghanistan and stopping any prospective war against Iran. And we go over to the rally live now and hear how it's going on. I should have Stephen Williams, the MP for Bristol West, on the line now. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon to you.
And how are you on this very cold day?
Yes, it's a bit chilly. We walked all the way from Castle Park in front of the BRI down Park Street to College Green, where, as you may be able to hear in the background, the final speech of the rally is taking place at the moment. And it is a bit cold, yes.
How's the rally been going? Is it quite busy?
Yes. I think there are probably about 150 people walking along in the rally, but lots of people on the pavements or even in the cars who were being held up were tooting their horns, more in support, I think, rather than the exasperation at being held up.
Okay. What is the Liberal Party's official line on Iraq and Afghanistan?
Well, the rally today was specifically about that there should be no attack on Iran. Obviously, the Liberal Democrats did not support in any way the invasion of Iraq, and we've made it quite clear that, Gordon Brown, as it now is, should not follow his predecessor, Blair, into an act of absolute folly with the Americans and any military action at all against Iran.
Okay, and what is your own personal view on the subject?
My own personal view is exactly the same. To be perfectly honest, I think the Iranian regime is a vile, awful regime that does terrible things both to women and other minorities within its borders. But it's up to the Iranian people to remove that regime. It's not up to us or the United States to remove them by force from outside. It's up to the Iranian people to do it. It's up to us to use diplomacy within the United Nations to achieve peaceful change.
I mean, if people inside Iran did ask for some sort of outside help, do you think that an attack on Iran could be sort of justifiable under those circumstances?
No, I don't. I don't think any military attack, whether it's on Iran or any other country in the region, is going to be helpful either to Iranians internally or to wider peace in the world. I'm 100% confident that any military attack in the Middle East would simply foment even more terrorism. Blair was warned that an attack on Iraq would make terrorism worse, and this country's own safety, the United Kingdom's own safety, worse as well. He ignored that advice and made the biggest foreign policy mistake of the last 50 years, I think. Hopefully, Gordon Brown won't be so stupid as his predecessor, but you never know, do you?
Yeah. I mean, do you think there would be any moral difference in UN interaction in Iran and non-UN interaction?
I think that certainly working through the United Nations and through diplomacy is the only way to resolve most world conflicts. And there is certainly a big role for the UN to play in trying to control the excesses of the Iranian regime. But whether the Iranian regime will listen to reason, I don't know. But even if they don't, then a military attack is not the first thing that should be considered. I'm not a pacifist in any sense, and neither is my party. So So there is sometimes a role for the military abroad, for instance, to protect people who are being persecuted in the former Yugoslavia, in Kosovo and Bosnia. There was certainly a role for British and American forces in that, and I supported that. But at the moment, I do not see that military intervention in Iran should be contemplated, and what's more, I think our own British troops should be withdrawn from Iraq as well.
Right. I mean, aren't voters really more concerned about stuff that's actually happening right now here at home? For example, Northern Rock, or the government allowing their private bank account details to be stolen, for example?
Well, yes, of course. Particularly in the constituency I represent, Bristol West, I can assure you that people write to me about hundreds of things every week. And most people are worried about domestic concerns, such as education, the health service, the poor transport that we have in Bristol as well. But I do get a large number of letters about the international situation, whether it's climate change or whether it's poverty in Africa or indeed the Middle East situation. So my constituents are worried about a whole range of things. I would say at the moment, I think you're quite right, that a speculation about attack on Iran would not be top of their list. But then if you go back, say, 5 years, most people probably didn't think that attacking Iraq was a mistake either.
Mm. I mean, the Liberal Democrats have been quite vociferous in their anti-war opinions. Is there not a danger of over-identifying the party with foreign affairs, and people are going to be left wondering what your domestic priorities are?
No, I don't think so. I mean, our opposition to the war in Iraq is certainly something that is distinctive to the Liberal Democrats. But I think people also know that we are the leading party and have been for many years on calling for action on climate change and having green energy and green transportation measures, more intervention and investment in education, better investment in public health care. For instance, I won an award for my work on the smoking ban, which has now been a great success for the last 5 months. You know, who would contemplate going back to reintroducing smoking? So my party has campaigned on many things, and I certainly have personally. We're certainly not a one-club golf outfit.
Okay, I mean, on the Northern Rock front, I mean, how confident are you and the Liberal Democrats, how confident are you that our money is safe in banks and building societies at the moment? Maybe we should be sort of keeping our money under our mattress.
I can't be confident about whether people's money is safe in any particular bank. It's not really for me to say. Mm. But the government has extended a guarantee to Northern Rock savers, and I guess if your money is in Northern Rock and the government's given a full guarantee to the tune of £24 billion at the moment, then your money is probably safer there than it is anywhere else in the country. But this is probably not the place to give financial advice to people.
Yeah.
But it does show that the government is getting itself tangled up in many financial messes at the moment, which are largely of its own making, by cutting the number of civil servants, particularly in revenue and customs, who have to make the whole system of regulation and taxation and child benefit work.
Okay. On both the Northern Rock and Iraq fronts, I mean, is there not a clash of priorities if the government can spend billions on giving money to Northern Rock, and yet our troops in Iraq are crying out for more funds to be able to successfully tackle the war?
Well, obviously, all governments have to juggle their resources. I mean, the money in Northern Rock that you're referring to is a guarantee. I mean, it's not cash spent at the moment, so it would only be called in if the bank actually did collapse and people's savings were lost and were not sufficiently balanced by the assets that the company has. But that I hope is not going to happen.
Right. On the party front, who is your personal favourite for the Liberal leadership at the moment?
I am supporting Nick Clegg for leadership of the Liberal Democrats. I think he's got the energy and the passion and the communication skills to lead the party on to even greater successes at the next general election.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for coming on the line today, Stephen Williams.
Okay.
I could ask you to hand over to Christina or Martin, our other two guests at all, if they're around, please.
So you want to speak to?
Who is both Christina Zaber and Martin Summers there at the moment?
Yes, Christina is standing right next to me, so I will hand you over now.
Thank you very much for your time today.
Hello.
Hello, good afternoon, Christina. How are you?
It's very, very faint.
Okay, I'll try and speak up a little bit. How are you today, Christina? Is it quite cold?
Sorry?
How are you today? Can you hear me?
I'm very well. Are we on air?
You are indeed.
Oh, brilliant. Okay.
Okay, yeah. I'm speaking now to Christina Zaber, who's the chair of the National Union of Journalists and a No2ID spokesperson. Which hat are you wearing today? Journalists Union or No2ID or both?
It's all the same thing, really, isn't it? It's about working for democracy. Today we're at the Stop the War Coalition's demonstration against war in Iran, and I'm representing the National Union of Journalists and the trade union movement here today.
Okay. So, I mean, in your capacity as a journalist, why come speak at this rally? Why not just express yourself through the Evening Post or the Western Daily Press?
Well, it's very, very important to meet people and to talk. It's important to support rallies and to support demonstrations, which are the expression of democratic will. But the other thing also is it's important to explain to people just what it is that journalists do go through, because a lot of people have the wrong idea about the media. They think we sit on our bums in warm offices typing away and being nasty about everybody.
Yes.
And it's really not true. 148 journalists worldwide have lost their lives in the last 12 months reporting on areas of struggle and strife. And so we know more than anybody just what the fallout, the human cost is of war, because we're the ones who actually go in the front line and look at it and report on it and tell the stories and take the pictures and kneel over the dead bodies and watch the women weeping. You know, journalists experience a lot of trauma. So to come and talk at the Stop the War rally is absolutely a logical thing to do.
Okay.
The other thing is also that in Bristol we all have to work together as different groups and different organisations and unite against really bad things that are going on in the world. That's how our voice will be heard, and that's why I'm here today.
Okay. So what, if any, is the connection between the identity cards issue and the Stop the War movement?
Well, it's all about the government and the government's arrogance. Basically, this government, sadly, although it's a Labour government, isn't behaving in a way that empowers the people of this country at all. And we see that in its absolute arrogant disregard for the millions of people who are opposed to war in the Middle East, be it Iraq or now Iran. And it's that same arrogant disregard for normal people's wishes in this country, which is putting into place the most draconian and vicious computerized system of surveillance and control ever seen anywhere in the world. It's absolutely shocking, and it does have to be stopped.
I mean, why should anybody mind having an ID card if they've nothing to hide?
Well, because it's not an ID card. What it is something called transformational government. Now, Tony Blair believes that technology can transform government. What that means is he can lay everybody off and make the work be done by computers. And in order for that to happen, 265 government departments are already sharing electronic data about each of us online. And that is going to get a whole lot worse. It's going to spread. The ID card means that every single person in this country will have their own identifying computer number, which will gather together every bit of information on any government computer anywhere about them under one number. And that means that that our identities online will be very, very easily stolen or lost. Now, we've seen this just this week, 25
Indeed.
Million people's personal details have been just lost by a government department. That's quite an innocent kind of thing compared to what's going to happen. The fact is, computer experts tell us that the government is lunatic. None of this technology will be secure. The technology does not exist to keep 60 million people's personal details, bank details, employment details, addresses, health records, shopping habits and everything else that's all going to be on the ID card. The technology just does not exist to keep these things secure.
Okay.
And so the government, again, is behaving arrogantly, disregarding good advice from sensible people and disregarding the will of citizens, because if the public really understood how much information is being stored and shared and looked at by 250,000 government employees passed around from department to department, and this is actual government policy, mind you.
Okay.
They are being made to do this, otherwise they'll be closed down, so they don't have a choice.
Okay,
if the public really knew how much information is being held about them and used about them and how they're being followed, there would be an absolute riot in this country. People don't know, and they do need to know. And that's what the No to ID campaign is about.
Okay, well, thank you very much. I'm going to have to stop you there, I'm afraid, Christina, because we're running out of time, I'm afraid. Thank you very much for speaking to us today, and I hope the rest of the rally goes well. Is Martin Summers available at all? Is he around?
Martin's there, yeah. I'll hand you over now.
Thank you very much. Thank you. I should have Martin Summers, the chair of the Bristol Stop the War Coalition, coming online in just a second.
Hello,
is that Martin Summers?
It is, yes.
Hi, good afternoon. How are you doing today?
Well, I'm a bit cold because we've been standing around here in the cold having our demonstration and our rally.
Okay, can you hear me okay?
Yes, I can.
Okay, excellent. Well, Bristol, along with Edinburgh, is one of the only places in the country to have a daily anti-war vigil ever since 9/11. So tell us about that. When and where does it take place?
The anti-war vigil in Bristol has been going on since 3 days after the September 11th attacks, and it takes place every evening from 5:30 to 6:30 opposite the Hippodrome in the centre of town by the fountains. It's been going every day, every weekday since then, and at 3 o'clock on Saturdays, and it's been continuous for the last 6 years nearly.
Yeah. So why have you organised this event today?
I think we're all very concerned about the war drums banging over Iran, and no doubt your previous speakers have mentioned the reasons why they've come on the demonstration today. We're very worried that a further escalation of war in the Middle East is being contemplated.
Okay. Unfortunately, because we're running out of time, I'm going to have to stop you there, unfortunately. But thank you very much for speaking to me today.
Well, thank you very much for putting us on.
Oh, you're very welcome, and I hope the rest of the rally goes well. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Radio Dialect is your local internet radio station. Check our website on radiodialect.net.
Radiodialect.net. Radiodialect.net.
Radiodialect.net.
And now it's that time of the week again. It's time for our very own What's On with our very own Jeff Sparks.
Thank you, Lisa. Good afternoon. This is your What's On guide from Radio Dialect. Seeing as we are broadcasting the middle of this weekend, I'll be bringing you some of the best gigs for next weekend. Kicking the weekend off a day earlier, on Thursday 29th of November at the Croft, we have Japanese three-piece Electric Eel Shock performing with support. Doors open at 8 p.m. and tickets are £7.50 in advance. Now, we'll mention this gig was due to be at the Fleece, but now it's been changed to the Croft. Moving on to Friday 30th of November, and at the King's Arms at 1 Monmouth Place in Bath, the punk covers group The Sex Pistols will be performing. The gigs will start around 9 p.m. and entry is free. Moving on to Song of the Week, and this week the honours go to Electric Eel Shock. This is from the latest album, Trans World Ultra Rock, and is a track titled Limousine.
Limousine, we got to our club, limousine. Hey, 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 go.
That was Electric Eel Shock with the track Limousine. For more information on this group, you can check them out at www.electriceelshock.com. Keeping with Friday 30th November, and at St. James's Wine Vault in Bath, the blues guitarist In Saboon will be performing. The gigs should start around 9 p.m. and entry is free. Moving on to Saturday 1st of December, and at the Louisiana in Bristol, Dead World Leaders will be performing. Doors open at 8 p.m. and entry is £4 on the door. Also on Saturday, and at the Old Duke in King Street, Bristol, the ever-popular group Dynamo Rhythm Aces will be performing. The gigs should start around 9 p.m. and entry is free. Finally, on Sunday 2nd of December, at the Rose of Denmark in Hotwells, Bristol, the singer-songwriter-guitarist Phil King will be performing. The gigs should start around 4 p.m. and entry is free. That is all from me. Thanks for listening and have a good week. Take care and goodbye.
Radio Dialect is your local internet radio station. Check our website on radiodialect.net.
Radiodialect.net.
Excellent. Well, we're now over to some live music in the studio. I've got a chap named Jem Bowden, who's here with me now. Hello, how you doing?
All right, yeah, all right, fine, thanks.
Cool. Okay, he's got his Spanish guitar, and I think we'll let his music speak for him, speak for itself. So straight over to a song.
You okay, great. Thanks very much. Yeah, this is a song called Legendary Lives. Your situation, and do you count your blessings to help you sleep? Sometimes you think too much about these things, and awkward questions go unanswered. Could we bear it to be sure?
shed. We all want to live legendary lives. Awkward silence. It doesn't matter. Was Liberace gay? Well, who killed Diana? We all want to run when there's somewhere to hide. And we're all pushing the truth to the back of our minds. It can't be denied. Legendary lies.
Hey. That was excellent. All right, well, how long have you been playing guitar then, Jem?
Ooh, how long have I been playing guitar? Well, I sort of play guitar sort of to write, but I suppose I've been doing that for about, since I was about 14, 15, something like that.
Right, okay. So have you been in quite a number of bands, quite a long history of doing stuff?
Yeah, from that time, really.
Yeah.
I sort of started playing bass in bands, I suppose, and then done my stint as a drummer as well. And but I've always sort of written, so... Last sort of 5 or 6 years, I've just been doing being in bands where I was the, sort of the main writer.
Okay, I could hear sort. I remember you saying earlier some people described you as sort of being a bit like the Fall, but I could hear a bit of sort of Ray Davies and Mitch Benn and all sorts in there. What do people sort of say? Think of your performances. To what sort of reaction do you get?
Mixed, I'd say.
Yeah.
Sometimes quite muted. I don't know. It's there's normally a few very enthusiastic people, and then. Quite a lot of people who have gone or something like that. I think.
So, are you in a band at the moment, or are you just solo?
I'm not in a band at the moment. Until recently, I was in a duo with a cello called Sunday Painters, and we did a number of gigs around Bristol. At the moment, I've decided to go back to basically solo, really, to do a whole load of new material that I've been working on. I haven't played live for about 6 months or so. And so gone back to the beginning to doing open mics, that kind of thing, to gauge reaction of a different set of, and it's quite different type of song, really, I think.
Okay. For guitar sort of enthusiasts, have you always been an acoustic man? Sort of what's your angle?
No, not at all, actually. I spent most of my time being in electric bands, and I think a lot of people sort of are surprised, or you think my stuff might be better suited to electric bands, it might well be, but I like the sound of a Spanish guitar, and more importantly, I really got fed up with all the equipment and effects and things like that, and it doesn't hurt your hand to play a Spanish guitar, and you can play it for a long time, and so that suits me, really, yeah.
Where do you look for sort of inspiration? You think, oh, I'm going to write a song, do you sort of sit down and go, right, I'm going to write a song now, or does it sort of come
no,
to you?
No, I think it's sort of... I'm always sort of writing or working on something, and it's normally something will happen that's humorous that you overhear, or you know, just, and so it sort of sparks off an idea, I think, or not necessarily humorous, but something will happen and you think that's definitely worthy of sort of working into some kind of product, being a song in my case normally.
Do you sort of just try out a few different styles? Does it all kind of come into one particular sort of style you're songwriting, or do you think?
I try to be eclectic, really, I think. I mean, it's not that I try to be eclectic, but I try to do different things all the time, because I definitely don't want to be repeating myself.
Okay. Are you going to be gigging any time soon around Bristol, do you think, on your own?
In terms of proper gigs, I dare say it won't be long. I haven't got anything gig-wise lined up, but I'm going to be playing a lot of the open mics.
Okay. You've given me a couple of MySpace addresses, if I can read your handwriting. Rich Fool Rough Methods, is that right?
Yeah, Rich Fool Rough Methods.
So that'd be MySpace.com, obviously, /... Rich Fool Rough Methods. And in relation to your previous project with the cellist, Proper Sunday Painters. So that's MySpace.com.
The Rich Fool Rough Methods was a site that was for any possible Sunday Painters enthusiasts, where they could hear very recent, very rough demos. So I better put something decent on there soon.
Okay. Whereabouts do you go to do open mics?
Oh, most of the ones I know about just from looking in venue. So sort of they're all over Bristol, really.
Okay, so any regular sort of venue readers, if you see any open mics, the chances are you may meet Jem there. Well, if you'd like to play us another song.
Okay. Well, this was a bit of a... At one point I decided I'd stop writing songs, but I couldn't really manage that, and then I thought I'd write a Christmas song for a laugh. I like a few of those Christmas songs, so... this was sort of going to be in the vein of one of those sort of glam rock 70s ones.
Wow.
Wizard sort of thing, but rock. It probably isn't, it's probably just me now, you know.
Okay.
Okay, it's called Is It Christmas Yet? Obviously it isn't. But. Is it Christmas yet? Is it Christmas yet? Is it Christmas yet? You go to work, you don't see daylight. Is it Christmas yet? You can't get the girl of your dreams out of your head. Is it Christmas yet? Kirsty and the Pogues are on. Is it Christmas yet? Tracking snow clouds on the winter web. Ah! Is it Christmas yet? Cards have all been passed out. You had a few and you're well on the way. You're full of expectation. Are you gonna get what you want? Fireworks are all burned out, like the joy of last year's toys. New girl at work just might be the one. Is it Christmas yet? The grass is always greener, she says. Love is not just for Christmas. And what you want, well, you don't even know. Ho ho, Christmas Eve is turned out. You drank enough and you're speaking the truth. And soon the floodgates open. And breaking up is what Christmas means this time of year. All this festive cheer hides some bitter tears through the mists of time. There's a gift divine. Oh, the holy. Of New Year's Eve now, turn another new leaf. But if there's cake, you'll eat it, 'cause there's too much love inside you at this emotional time. Even Superman makes you cry. Oh, roll on February, as desire runs free. Hope he doesn't forget me. Oh, good old Father C. Yeah. Father C. Yeah. Are you gonna get what you want? Are you gonna get what you want? Are you gonna get what you want? Is it Christmas yet?
Cheers. Thank you, Jem. Have you any plans to sort of record that at all?
Oh, yeah, there is a plan to record that, actually. Yeah, just sort of more or less for a laugh, really. Get some sort of sleigh bells on it and give it the glam rock treatment with a friend who's a drummer and a backing singer and maybe others.
So there may yet be a band with you in it.
Yeah, there might be again one day, I think.
Oh, well, thank you very much for coming in. Just to reread out those websites if you want to check out more. Myspace.com and then / Rich Fool Rough Methods or / Proper Sunday Painters. Thank you very much.
You're listening to Radio Dialect.net.
Now it's time for our weekly dip into the audio archive. This week we're going into the hotspot of Palestine during the Second World War, where we hear from a military man by the name of Sir Gawain Waistry Bell, KCMG, CBE, author of the book Shadows in the Sand. He worked in the Sudan from 1931 to 1938 as a member of the Sudan Political Services, but served during the war in Palestine in the Middle East.
In 1937, Palestine was in a very disturbed state, and the High Commissioner was a man called McMichael, who had previously served in the Sudan. And in 1937, I think I'm speaking of, yes, in 1937, 1937, 38, there was a great deal of disturbance in Palestine, a great number of people were killed, 3,000 in point of fact, on both sides, on the government side and on the side of the local people. And it was a revolt, of course, against Jewish immigration, we know. And several district commissioners had been killed. And so the Governor General, the High Commissioner McMichael, he said to himself, I've got to replace these people, and it's no good replacing them with people who don't understand Arabic, because you've got to talk to the Arabs. And so he turned to his old service, which was the Sudan service, and he asked for two volunteers who would be prepared to go to Palestine on secondment for 2 years, provided they were bachelors. And I volunteered, together with a man called Arthur Charles. Arthur Charles was later killed in Aden. And we were selected from, I don't know how many people in fact put up their names, I should think a dozen or so, from young assistant district commissioner in the Sudan. And we were to go in the early autumn or late summer of 1938, but Munich came, if you remember. There was the Munich crisis. And when the Munich crisis came, they thought there was going to be a war. I was held back in the Sudan because they said, if there is going to be an immediate war, we don't want to release anybody at once. We'd like to wait and see what we require. So we were delayed a bit, but then Munich passed, and our order came through, and we both went up. We did, Charles, after Charles and I, and we were posted to our districts in the Sudan. He went to Jerusalem, and I went to Nazareth and Tiberias. And I found when I went there that my office had been burnt and there were no files at all. And I had two district officers working under me. One was a Jew and one was an Arab. But neither would speak to the other. And neither would take any official action except through me. And then the Arab district officer was shot, and his successor came, and he stayed for 3 days, and then he went to the doctor and said, my heart is very bad. So he was sent away. The Jewish district officer remained. But the country then was pretty well ungovernable. The southern part of Palestine had all fallen to the Arab freedom fighters, rebels, gangs, whatever you like to call them. And there were no British troops or anything south of Hebron. In the north, which I went to, which was Tiberias, there were plenty of British troops. And I think there were altogether 16 battalions of British troops in that tiny country of Palestine at that time. And so the army had to be in control of pretty well everything. There wasn't martial law, but there were certain military regulations which controlled the people and their movements and this, that and the other, which were really administered by the army. And there was not very much that I could do as a district commissioner in Palestine at that time, except to remain with the army and try and act as a kind of liaison between the army on the one hand and the Jews on the other, and the Jews were only too anxious to entertain one and make themselves as pleasant as they possibly could be, and the Arabs, who were mostly in a state of being pressed on one hand by the government during the day in the army, and on the other by the rebel gangs who came into their villages at night and said, we want 20 volunteers to attack a Jewish settlement tomorrow, please, and 10 rifles. And if they didn't do that, well, then they got into trouble. So the villagers were in a very difficult and uncomfortable position squeezed on the one hand by the government during the day mostly. The government moved around by day, mm-hmm. but it didn't move around by night, and the gangs who moved mm-hmm. around by night, and who would demand money from the village and supplies and this, that, and the other. So they had a bad time in the villages. A villager, the poor man, always has a bad time, as he does now, doesn't he, in Africa and all over the place.
Sir Gawain Westry Bell, KCMG CBE there, in an interview recorded in 1995, explaining, amongst other things, the terrible plight of the ordinary villagers during the Second World War and in the run-up to the creation by the British government of the State of Israel. And there'll be more from the Palestine of Sir Gawain Westry Bell next week.
Well, there's just time for one last story I spotted in today's Western Daily Press. A bubbleologist squeezed 50 schoolchildren inside a soap bubble, breaking the world record in the process. Sam Heath, a.k.a. Sam Sam Bubble Man, used a 12-metre or 39-foot bubble wand to create a soap bubble around the children at the Science Museum in London. The school children, all of whom had to be over 5 foot tall for the record to count, stood on a large platform surrounded by a moat of soapy water. Heath used the wand to make a bubble enclosing the whole group, succeeding at the fourth attempt. The bid was declared official by a Guinness World Record adjudicator. Wicked. Well, that's all for this week's 24th of November show, recorded in the Headley Radio Room at the British Empire and Commonwealth Museum by Bristol's Temple Meads Railway Station. Dialect is a community internet radio station run by the Bristol Broadband Cooperative. That means anyone that listens to this programme, or anyone who doesn't, can contribute. If you'd like to get involved, either in reporting, production, or on the engineering side, do please get in touch by calling Volunteering Bristol on 0117 989 7733. Or you can find them on the web at www.bristolvolunteers.org.uk. Today's studio manager was Vilas Chitrakuran. The reporters were Anthea Page, Tony Gosling and Lisa Braden. The presenters were Lisa Braden and myself, John Peters Coleman, and the producer was Tony Gosling. Thank you to Jen Bowden, and also for our phone interviewees today, Stephen Williams, Kristen Sabre and Martin Summers. We look forward to your company again next week for Dialect's unique blend of arts and news from Bristol to Bristol and the globe. So for myself and the rest of the Dialect team, have a very good week. Take care.